Now, Thoreau points out, the best educated state in India, people are not as literate as in the worst educated province of China. This is just a pattern. The problem in Vietnam was they didn't have the resources to extend this all the way, so there you didn't have a high degree of literacy, as high as there could be. But, you know, people were smart. As smart as there were anybody, as anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
So what this meant was, when there's a construction project, you know, I could see this. When somebody was building a house or a warehouse or something, the ratio of supervisors to workers was extremely high because people hadn't learned skills that involved writing. You couldn't post written instructions. You couldn't take people and say, here's a blueprint. Okay? The people who could do that were all working for the government.
Yeah.
Okay? So, at not very high cost, you can spread this out. Then what you can do is you can take bright people and they can learn the technology really quickly. So you can do high-tech things real quick. I mean, here's a high school kid. They boost him up.
He figures it out.
He's got the manual. He takes it back off the TV set and he finds how they fixed it and he unfixes it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? We had a kid there. This is a marvelous story. When Bob Walker showed up, this kid, his name, Nguyen Van Hien, not the same name as the other Nguyen Van Hien I mentioned. The other fellow was Hien. This guy was Hien. Okay. Hien was a high school kid, and he came around looking for maybe he could earn a few bucks to help his family by being an interpreter.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked with Bob Walker and he worked with some of the other AID people. Hien had taught himself English. Literally.
Mm-hmm.
He had learned it out of a book because his English was virtually fluent by the time we got there. He had an enormous vocabulary. He hadn't gotten that from his school. I know that.
Mm-hmm.
The classes were, you know, not that well developed. He had also taught himself Chinese, and he was pretty good in French. Terribly bright fellow.
And hardworking.
Yes.
There's something driven there, which is beyond intelligence.
That's right. Now, Tom Mahoney, the guy I mentioned before, and the USIS guy,
mm-hmm.
Recognized this, and USIS had this program, connection with the American Field Service, and they were looking for kids to spend a year in America with living with an American family and going to high school.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they chose them was they had an essay contest, where you'd write an essay and give a speech in Saigon. And, you know, the idea that some kid from the provinces would participate in this was, you know, this is a little bit beyond belief.
Yeah, yeah.
But Hien wrote his on Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech.
Uh-huh.
And went down and won the scholarship.
Uh-huh.
And spent a year living with a family in Colorado and going to high school in Colorado. He almost didn't make it because the day the plane was supposed to leave, it was not propitious according to what the astrologer said. Hien's parents came from North Vietnam. They lived in what was literally a one-room shack.
Uh-huh.
Hien was a young man at this age was spanning the centuries, spanning a century,
mm-hmm.
19th to 20th, late 20th. There was a problem because Hien was engaged to be married.
Mm-hmm.
He's 16 or 17 years old, but when he was five, his father and the girl's father back in North Vietnam had made an arrangement. And the parents wouldn't leave him, let him leave the country unless he got married first. And so the couple set up housekeeping in a corner of the house where there was a cord and a sheet draped over, so they had their own
privacy.
Yeah. Such as it was.
Yeah.
Because I think what the parents wanted was they wanted a grandchild on the way before the kid would leave the country. Which is the way it worked out.
Mm-hmm.
And he came back from this year abroad, and of course, his experiences and horizons were very different from what they had been when he left.
But he's a father now.
Now, so I'm trying to remember whether the baby was born. There was a second trip to America, during the first trip or the second trip. But he came back, and he spent his last year of high school in Fontiette, this time acting as an interpreter, because, I mean, before his English was very good, and his written English was certainly better than that of any of the people he was helping, but now, of course, it was just superb. And he won a scholarship and ended up taking an undergraduate degree in Princeton.
Mm. Wow. Okay.
Somewhere along the line, he's become a father here.
Okay.
And he was not very happy with the marriage because she's a nice girl, but she was not interested in education. She did not know how to read and write, so she would want him to write letters for her and read letters to her. And the gap was quite large. And he was a good, dutiful son. But he went off to Princeton, and after Princeton, he had a fellowship to the University of Pittsburgh, and he took a master's degree in administration there. And he, the last time I saw him, he was in Minneapolis. He was working for a consulting firm that was doing a research project under contract to the American government, interviewing refugees from Vietnam. And he happened to be in Minneapolis. As you know, there are a lot of Vietnamese people came to Minneapolis. And he hadn't seen his family in a long time. He hadn't seen his child in a long time. And it was a very painful thing for him. And I don't know how that's all worked out. You know, he would send them back care packages and so on and letters. But you can imagine how difficult it would have been to be a modern man.
Mm-hmm. With a traditional wife like that. And a traditional family and expectations and such.
Literally living in the grass shack. And, he's writing books and he's the only one in the family who can read books in any language.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, you know, this is a guy who, incredible talent. Now, that was the fella I met, and the other one, Chum, who wanted to become an engineer, and I heard later on, did study engineering in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to get him into UMass Boston. I came back, I was in graduate school, and no, you know, I'll be his guardian, I'll guarantee all this stuff, and it just never worked out.
Uh-huh.
But here are these two kids with enormous talent, and all these high school kids, you know, extremely talented. Those are the ones I met. There must have been thousands that I didn't.
Of course.
And this is a country where The groundwork for economic development is well laid. What has delayed it has been first the war, and second, you know, from what I've read, the imposition of socialism, which has just strangled all of this.
Mm-hmm.
There is a young fella who lives in Bloomington, a suburb of Minneapolis. His name is Sean Nguyen. Now, what an American story. Sean, S-E-A-N,
mm.
right? Sean Nguyen. Sean Nguyen came here, I believe, in the second wave of refugees.
Hang on a second.
Yeah.
Okay, rather than following that up, I want to go back just a bit pre-Tet. And I know that we were getting right into Tet, and it fit naturally there, so I just thought we'd do that. But come back to this. The resignations of the leadership of IBS,
yeah,
which was in September, actually the letter was dated 19th of September of 67. What discussions among volunteers preceded that? And were you a part of any of those discussions?
Yeah. You want this on the tape?
Yeah. It's thrilling.
Oh, it is? Oh,
yeah.
I thought you'd... Okay,
no,
what's on?
No.
There was a meeting in Saigon. I was not there. I was involved in stuff in Phan-Tiet.
Yeah.
Okay? But I heard about this. There was a lot of talk about it. Somebody from Saigon came up to talk to me about it.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember who?
I see his face in front of me.
Okay.
And the name is flown out of my mind.
All right.
And I remember we went for a walk. We walked down to the public square.
Mm-hmm.
And there were all these kids, school children, been organized into a demonstration. And lots of banners. And the most frequently carried banner said, "Hua Bing Ai Chave, peace should soon return."
Mm-hmm.
And he turned to me and he said, "How many of these children do you think will grow up if this continues?"
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a very strong effect on him. And I had a hard time making that decision because I was very sympathetic with the people who were leaving. But I stayed, and the reason that I chose to...
Did you sign on the letter just in terms of sympathy for...
You know, I don't recall.
Okay.
I don't think so.
Okay.
And I can... because I remember thinking about the problem.
Yeah.
And one of the things I remember was if I was going to stay there, signing the letter would be a problem.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
And the reason I
AID
did this,
people would not like it.
Oh, no.
No.
And I remember, that's
a deliberate understatement.
Earlier, I told you about this, you know, this wonderful man, Chester Richardson, who made it very clear he would take this personally.
Yeah.
And Chet was like a father figure. This is a hard thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought about this really hard. It was probably the hardest decision I've made in my life up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that's not saying much. I was that kid. You know, what the hell?
Yeah, but it's the first real adult with a moral crisis and you having to make a statement.
And I figured my situation was a little different because, as I was telling you earlier, you know, when Linda was here, I was very useful just in being able to step in and intervene and stop crazy things from happening.
Yeah.
And that just may have been because at that time, Phan-Tiet didn't have that many Americans there. We were a close-knit group. I had some credibility with these folks because of the other things I mentioned. And they understood I had a different point of view, but
we're not hostile.
Yeah, exactly.
But signing the letter
exactly
is hostile.
Exactly. And I figured that the real question was, do you go or do you stay?
Uh-huh.
And where I was still useful. And later on, I wasn't and I left.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I realized I can't accomplish anything more here. But those little interventions and driving people to the police lines and so on, that did accomplish something. You could do that in Pontiac, you couldn't do it elsewhere. So I stayed.
Mm-hmm.
And for that reason, I don't think I signed the letter. I think the people who made the other decision did the right thing. I think I did the right thing, too. We were in different circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the argument that this fellow made to me was that this may be Fontiette, but what we're talking about is the whole country, the whole war.
Yeah.
And we need signatures on the petition.
Mm-hmm.
He may have been right. I don't know. I still haven't figured that one out.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I made the wrong call, but as I look back on it, that was a judgment call. It was a judgment of facts and probabilities, and it was a judgment about what the situation was.
Mm-hmm.
And my assessment of it may not have been accurate. But I think that from an ethical point of view, I think I did the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the other people did the right thing, too. Now, later on, I heard that what they did, I mean, I was up in Fontiette. What the hell do I know? I read about it in Time and Newsweek.
Yeah.
In addition, 6 weeks late, when they finally worked their way through the soldiers who were about ready to throw them away, I read one of these places that the letter had been released to the press before it was delivered to the intended recipient, and that caused real rage. And my reaction then was, so what?
Yeah, good.
Yeah, so what? Maybe real rage will get them to think about what's going on. Because I remember reading the letter.
Staying on the inside doesn't work.
The letter was right on the mark.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I agreed with it 100%. It was just a matter of, I don't think I signed it, and if I had signed it, it would have made doing what I was doing in Fontiette very difficult, and then there would be no point in staying. So
mm-hmm.
It wasn't signing or not signing, it was stay or go.
Yeah, okay. And the stuff that you were doing in Fontiette, in being able to act as that outsider with the prestige to push things through, you gave the example of helping the students get the stuff they needed for the refugee camps. Now, of course, that was Ted. That's a little after the letter.
Yes.
But there were other things, too.
Yeah, the
you
incident
could give a couple.
The incident where the American officer and his unit were going to had cordoned off all the settlement. We're going to, and we're convinced that there were enemy people hiding out there, and they were just going to flatten everything.
Was that
from
a
distance? No, that was before Ted.
Oh, that was before Ted.
Yeah.
Okay, I wasn't sure.
No, that was long before Ted.
Oh,
and,
so even long before the letter.
Oh yes.
Okay.
Yes. You know, these people didn't lose their houses. Their houses weren't much, but it was everything they had.
Yeah.
You know, just little things like, you know, once upon a time I was able to tell some officer, hey, if you don't drive these vehicles through the paddies, it's going to be a lot better for the people who live here. Because these heavy vehicles would go through the paddies.
They'd rip everything.
And worse than that, they would compact the earth and nothing would grow through it.
Yeah.
Okay. And just, you know, little things like that did accomplish something.
Mm-hmm.
So there was some value, and there are an awful lot of materials. I told you the story before, materials that I was able to get for people that gave them some protection.
materials?
Oh, the things like the rebar and the cement and the sandbags.
Yes.
Okay. You know, if they had gone in and said, look, we'll tell you what's going on in the neighborhood, you know, it's not true, as the police chief told you, that a company of enemy soldiers came and shot at the police station and fired rockets. What really happened was there were 8 men. They dug 4 foxholes, 2 to a foxhole. They fired the rifles a couple of times. There may have been 1 rocket, and then the police just fired all night long, and the policeman who died was probably shot by his own people. I mean, everybody in the neighborhood knew that. People were sympathizing with the enemy, would not have minded telling the Americans that. But when an American could go in and explain it and get them sandbags and other materials so they could build bunkers so that the next time it happened, they wouldn't get killed, this, yeah, this is worth something.
Yeah, this is a little better.
Yeah, yeah. An army unit living nearby, camp nearby, base nearby, excuse me.
Yeah.
Was burning up a lot of wood from ammunition cases. The 7th Cavalry had been there, and they had made hooches from this wood. The 101st had done this. The 7th Cavalry replaced them. And they said, no, we don't do that. We're real soldiers. And the order was given to tear these things down and burn them. A big hole was made in the earth. These things were tossed in. They were being burned. Wood in Vietnam was like gold, even soft wood. And I was able to cut a deal with the commander of that base that if we could haul the wood out of there and before it got into the pit, we could keep it. He didn't care as long as we got rid of it. The guy who was operating the backhoe said, well, you know, I don't have to rush. And I borrowed a flatbed truck from the Navy and went over to the pagoda and got a whole bunch of novices and Buddhist Boy Scouts. And for several days, this is right before Tet, we drove back and forth from the base to the village with all this wood, which was piled up in the pagoda. The wood was going to be used to make benches for the Buddhist school. They were building a new school. We did this right up until the day before Tet. And we had to stop because preparations had to be made
for Tet.
And that's why I didn't go to Tet that year. I didn't go to Hue that year. I was going to go to Hue for Tet.
Oh, you're lucky twice.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Because that could have been very unpleasant.
Yeah.
And
you could have been with Mark Haye and the other fellow.
Well, one of those guys was hidden under a bed for a month. They would have never fit me under one of those little Vietnamese beds. You know, they would have found me right away. The luck came out yet another time because suddenly we had all these refugees. Forget school furniture. This is how we build shelters.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are just a lot of little things like that. Might not have been part of the job description, but, gee, you know, if you can stop some of the insanity just by saying, excuse me, and they'll listen to you because you had a white face.
Yeah.
And they never really knew. You know, if you were a civilian, they never really knew what your, quote, rank, end quote, was because we didn't have insignia.
That's right. So you could have been a spook of high rank.
And in particular, one of the things that people notice, I found out later on, is if you walked around with the big cheese, they picked up that you addressed him by first name. So even though you were very young, you had to be somebody very important. Like maybe your father was in the government at a very high level because you could talk to the American province chief by first name. This is a big deal.
Sure.
Yeah. So
a kid from Minnesota who's drafted into the army can't do that to the colonel.
That's right. And so I was able to walk into a lot of offices. I was able to take Vietnamese people with me into a lot of places, and they get a hearing.
Mm-hmm. And things would be explained that otherwise would, there would be, for which there would otherwise be no knowledge.
And in other places, that couldn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
In Fonte, it could. Because when Tet came along, I don't think there were more than 10 American civilians there. You know, other than mm-hmm. the IBS mm-hmm. people. And most of those had very special jobs. There were very few of us, so we were all important, and we were all celebrities, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
and we could all go anywhere, and that paid off.
Yeah, and speaking of the paying off, and again, this is a story that you said before we started, when Linda James was still here.
Yeah.
It was a long story, so it might have to be a somewhat of truncated version. Now, but the story of the crossing of lines and a Mr. Mahoney.
Now, are you talking about taking the congressman in? I think we got that one.
No, about during his illness.
Yeah.
If that can be said again for the tape.
Yeah, Mahoney was a very, very nice fellow who was the USIS representative in the province,
mm-hmm.
the advisor to the Vietnamese Information Service. Mahoney was very unusual among American civilian employees in that he went out of his way to learn language and make contacts in the community, and he was well respected, and partly through my connections in the school, he had a couple of gatherings in his home that school teachers attended.
Uh-huh.
They did not feel that they were being tarnished by associating with an American.
In this case.
And what was rather spectacular about this was women teachers attended.
Uh-huh.
Escorted, of course.
Of course, but their husbands.
And wives would accompany their husbands. But there was nobody else who could have done this.
Uh-huh.
Because a Vietnamese woman who went to an American's home would lose her reputation. It didn't matter if she was with 30 other people. That's just the way it was. He was well regarded in the community. He got hepatitis. They shipped him out to Clark Air Force Base. And what he said to me was, what's going to happen is when they find out that I'm not here, they'll send the next guy who comes in country to my place, and when I get well, they'll send me somewhere else. And I want to be back here.
And he had been dating a woman.
Whom he eventually married, and they've got, last time I heard, 4 kids.
Uh-huh.
Now, what happened was he said, they'll never figure out I'm not here if the report's still going.
Yes.
And so, that's
periodic reports. Yeah.
So, he went off to Clark Air Base, and he had been very helpful to me, and he was a nice guy, and so I just sent in reports while he was away and signed his name.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody else in AID or CORDS or whatever they were calling it then understood what was going on, and they liked him and they wanted him back too. So,
nobody said anything.
Nobody said anything.
and you get to be him.
And I got to be him, and so I was doing the psychological assessment profile of the province that went into the Hamlet Evaluation Survey, the Solo Pools thing, and was in a way in charge of the amnesty program, the Chu Hoi program, and I think the part of the story that caught your attention before was also dealing with propaganda, and to the point where I would pick the places where the leaflets would be dropped.
This was cute, yeah.
And I told this guy who was flying in this, what I can consider only, should have been, it was called an O2B, it should have been called target practice. He was going to be flying over the forest in this little helicopter with no armor whatsoever driving these pamphlets.
And flying low.
Very low. I gave him coordinates that he said must have been wrong because they were out over the sea, and I said, well, you know, remember, I'm going to be writing something that goes in your fitness report. Use these coordinates. He was very happy. I was very happy.
And the fishes were happy.
And we reduced the litter. You know? I mean, I felt that was a useful useful function for me to perform.
Yeah.
And
it was a good use for the propaganda pamphlets.
Yeah, but mostly it increased the probability this guy would go home to his wife and family in one piece.
At least one less mission.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, I felt useful, and that's why I stayed. And as I said before, about the time when I saw another academic year looming, and I had, the decision was, do you stay for another year? About that time, I could see that the answer was no, and I came home.
Yeah. A kind of follow-up question. I've got a few follow-up questions. I begin, you know, asking a lot of people. Just like we've done the background things on a lot of people. This one's going to run out fairly soon. You went home because you saw that you couldn't do anything more. Do you think there... To continue the question... that was an individual decision. Do you think there was a point at which it might have been better for IVS as an organization and for its volunteers to have completely scaled back the program?
Well, I'm very confident in my answer to that question. The answer is I don't know.
Okay.
But let me just add a point on that, Paul.
Yeah.
As I indicated before, we were pretty much free operators. We were not micromanaged.
Right.
As a consequence, or I would say sort of a logical extension of that, when this decision came up, it wasn't enforced on us, nor was it one of those things, we'll take a vote and either we all stay or we all go home. It was left as an individual decision.
Mm-hmm.
That was completely uncharacteristic with the way the program was run. In retrospect, I still don't know.
Yeah.
I had the worm's eye view up in Fontiath. The people who were down in Saigon would know the answer to that a whole lot better than I. And my guess is most of them would say yes. It should have been wound up.
Yeah, I mean, not necessarily to send people home early, but you could say, well, you've got your 2 years, you've done 1 year, we'll wait to the end of the 2 years, and then we'll send you home. The person who just got here can still do his or her 2 years as well, but if you want to go home immediately, that's fine. But, you know, we won't kick anybody out, but we'll close it down because the war situation is just getting to be impossible. We can no longer function. All of the original goals of helping people, developing the country, are squished under the bombs and tanks.
Yeah, well, Don Luce tells a story about this, about his sweet potatoes.
Yes, I've heard his sweet potatoes.
Yep.
Well, the thing is, he also urged people to stay when he resigned because he thought it was valuable to continue to have a presence and continue to report back to him and the others who quit, you know, and who went back to the United States so that the communication would continue to come. But, you know, sooner or later that may be a...
Well, the one thing I don't know is, even to this day, maybe you can tell me, is how it played in the media back here, because some people left and some people stayed, and I don't know how many... You know, how many versus how many, maybe it would have been better if the whole group had left. I have no idea how it played back here, and that was a very important part of it because the goal was to bring this to the attention of the American people.
Yeah. Well, I can answer that often.
Okay, sure.
Yeah. I think that it, turn it on, and you can add this footnote. I'll have one last question, and
okay.
We'll have to wrap.
This is a question about the letter.
Okay.
There's another element to this. I don't know if other people have mentioned this, but I think it may have entered into some people's decision-making. There was also a question of abandoning people you live it among and become close to.
That's
you
been
could
mentioned,
go,
yeah.
Okay, you could go home. They were stuck with a situation.
Some people say we wanted to stay there so that they would know that someone cared, that we were standing with them.
I think the people who said that are better people than I am, because that's more generous way of looking at the world. I'm not that generous. What I would have said is, this is related to what people call survival guilt. You feel guilty about going home where it was safe.
Yeah, that would have been too.
It's more self-centered, but
mm-hmm.
You know, abandoning people, and then of course, if you didn't leave, and then Ted came. Well, nobody was going to leave right after Tet. My God, you know, you can't walk out on your friends after that's happened.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was a strong element. As far as it affected us, I think what you have to bear in mind is, from what you just told me, about half the people left.
Yeah, about half.
Okay?
No, Whitfield said he had to reduce the force by about half. And he was looking at whose jobs were continued to be viable, because so many people, particularly the rural areas, could not go back. The situation in Wei was very, very bleak because of the incredible destruction and carnage. They could not go back, etc., etc. And there'd be individual cases here and there. Some people just wanted out. That was easy, you know.
Yeah.
He said he didn't have to kick anybody out to cut the program down, but it was really easy to.
One of my students was buried alive in Wei.
Really?
I think a lot of people who lived in Wei would have held any American responsible for all the destruction that was visited on that city. I could see that. But as far as the effect on us was concerned, it wasn't just that very large number of people left. Don left. Three of the four team leaders left. Willie Myers left. Gene Stoltz was left. Don Ronk left.
Yeah.
But of the people who left, you're talking about people for whom we all had an enormous amount of respect.
Yeah.
Don and Willie and Gene. I mean, you can't meet these people. You can't be in their company for more than a half an hour without realizing that they are very special people. And that's the way it was sold to me. You know, Don's leaving, Willie's leaving, Gene's leaving.
And the other Don.
Yeah. That's right.
Uh-huh.
How do you explain this?
Uh-huh.
How can you stay here? Well, by the way, you happen to have an address for Don Rock?
I might.
Yeah, I'd like to know that.
Okay. Yeah. A final wrap-up question is a biggie.
Mm-hmm.
How would you say that the IVS experience has impacted on your life?
I can't think of any experience or any period in my life that it's had a larger impact.
Mm-hmm.
If I were to go into great detail to answer that question, you would be here for a very long time. I've already over-talked.
Well, you haven't. It's just that the schedule today is a little crazy.
Well, you know, a couple of points that spring to mind right away that are very important.
Uh-huh.
It made me think more than I perhaps otherwise would about the limitations of what people can do.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that I understand.
I was in college, and the solutions to various problems were all very simple and straightforward. In a situation like this one, life was very complicated. Earlier I said that one of the things that impelled me to go to Vietnam was curiosity. I couldn't believe either of the two stories I was hearing, and I wanted to find out which was true.
Mm-hmm.
While I was young and really naive and probably very stupid too, because I had to go to Vietnam to realize that neither was true and both were true. And life mm-hmm. was a whole lot more complicated than I thought, and it's a whole lot harder to solve problems. This tends to give one a somewhat more conservative outlook on life. Not conservative in the sense that that term is used politically today.
No, you're not voting for Gingrich, but you're not being swept away by simplistic solutions. You're taking your time to examine things carefully. Would that be a better?
I learned there that it's not enough to pass a resolution, take a vote, congratulate yourself, the problem has been solved.
Mm-hmm.
The rest is just working its way out. I learned how stubborn these things were. I also learned how stubborn these problems were. But on the other hand, I also learned how amenable that they were to solution. Not simple solutions, but solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And earlier when I was talking about literacy, technology, and so on, in this country, and I'm not going to presume that I know that much about it, and certainly not about others where I haven't been, I can see how much can be accomplished with a little bit in the way of resources, as long as people aren't held back.
Uh-huh.
And an example was a fellow I was starting to mention earlier, Sean Nguyen.
Yeah.
He came here at 18 years old after being in a refugee camp. He came from a small village. He's clever with his hands. He had to work. No time to go to college or
right.
resources.
Sure,
he started
not in
a little,
that situation.
Started a little company,
mm-hmm.
assembling boards for computers. Now he's got two of them. He's been very successful. He's good. He's been willing to take risks. He's very adept at what he's doing. And he's been a guest at the White House. He's been a guest at the governor's mansion. He's gone back to his home village, and he said, I want to set up an operation here where people can make the boards.
Uh-huh.
And, this village will go from poverty to a very comfortable prosperity.
Uh-huh.
And the only thing that's stopping him is the American government. Now, once the American government gets out of his way, the only thing that will stop him will be the Vietnamese bureaucracy. But it's so easy.
Mm-hmm.
The things we think are that we thought were easy are very difficult. The things that we thought were impossible really are easy.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, that's a good way to. It's a good illustrative story.
Yeah, that's what I learned.
Mm-hmm.
And that. The second most important thing I think I learned, and all the others pale into insignificance, so we can stop at two.
Okay.
The second most important thing that I learned was we really are all basically the same, but these cultural differences are enormous. And you have to take them into account. And so when I came back and I was in... at the university in the Institute of Agriculture, when the chairman of the department used to say, I can go to any country in the world and analyze its agricultural policy programs, I just go there and in 3 days I can do it, I realized that this man was operating under an illusion.
Mm-hmm.
One short story, very short story to exemplify this. The road I lived on was the road to the Province Hospital. One thing that I used to hear several nights a week, a quartet, was the sound of a wailing woman. Some poor woman whose husband or child had died in the hospital and was being peddled home by a pedicab driver who would be wailing. And I used to hear that and I thought, how can Americans be in this country for so long and still repeat this crap about how life is cheap in the Orient? And because I've been trained in economics,
I hate that.
What I said was, what they don't realize is saying life is cheap in the Orient is equivalent to saying we value life relative to freedom more highly than they do. If you say life is cheap in the Orient, freedom, national self-determination, the things that people on the other side were claiming to fight for, those things are cheap in America. How could we have so much contact with the society and still believe this twaddle? And not see what the implication is of our own statement about them, what it implies about us. I don't think I would have learned that in school.
No. No, you had to hear the woman wailing.
I said the others fail into insignificance. I'll add a third because this third thing really is important.
Okay.
People are wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when things get bad, people get better. And I didn't notice any cultural distinctions on that score. It's a cliche. People rise to the occasion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most of those bad occasions I saw were occasions that were made by people.
Yes.
But still, people are wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my view of my species went up a great deal, even after seeing all the insanity. Because when we organize, we may be crazy, but on an individual basis, we're pretty good. Now, those are things that have stuck. It's one of the reasons why I'm relocating as I am, because I decided, I look back over my life and I said, what were the periods of my life which I look back upon which I felt, I'm trying to think of the right word, fulfilled or whatever.
Yeah.
You go to bed at night and you say, hey, this is a good day. You did something. You accomplished something. There were two of them. They were my undergraduate years.
Uh-huh.
When I resented having to go to bed at night and I couldn't wait to get up in the morning. Because it felt like I was a sponge.
Yeah.
And I really liked that. Graduate school certainly takes that feeling away from you, as you know. And they were followed by the years in IBS.
Mm-hmm.
And so my original thought was, I had gone back to graduate school and had gotten a PhD relatively late in life. It's a little late to make an academic career, besides which, in the great academic opera, I'm always going to be one of those spirit carriers. I'm not going to be tenor. It's too late for that, and I didn't, there are very few people who have that kind of talent anyway, and I'm not one of them.
And the sacrifice to get that, is it worth it?
Well, on the other hand, it might be if you go abroad to some country where they're setting up a program and what they really need is some person who's well on in years, who who can be part of that core that starts it up so it's done properly, and then will be too old to continue, so he can step aside. You know, ideally you want to go someplace. Mongolia was one place that I was interested in. They're going to start a program. Okay, well, here's somebody who knows how to do things properly, and you work at it for a while, and you get to the point where hopefully one of your students who's gone abroad and gotten an advanced degree can come back, and at that point you can say, nice to see you, pal. I'm leaving. Now you take my place. Can't do that in this country. You can do that abroad, and I was looking at third world places, and most of those, it turns out, the problem is the places that have openings aren't ready to make this step. They just want somebody from a foreign university because it looks good. And so I'm going to a first world country instead of a third world country, but that remains a possibility. I wouldn't have thought in those terms without IBS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so it has also impacted your life in a direct way, in that way.
Every day.
Yeah. Not just the insights into the human dimension and character, but also in how you're programming your own attempts to grapple with life.
If you change the way a person looks at the world, Paul, you're going to change the way he stumbles his way through it.
I just glad to see that was included as one of the three.
Can I ask you something?
Sure.
When you interview people, now you're getting a biased sample, but when you interview people, what proportion of them have a very positive reflection on their time with IBS?
Oh, it's almost all.
This is what I would expect.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, some may have a problem with the organization. I mentioned the one woman who was let go because she married a USAID person, and someone who was let go because of a country director, chief of party at Laos, who was probably... who may have been acting, you know, or made a bad decision. But as an organization, no, no problem. And of course, there'd be their individual experiences, but that would vary no matter what the organization per se.
My guess is that almost everybody you talk to will tell you that we gave up very little of ourselves in comparison to what we received.
I was going to say that. Absolutely. Right now, I'll close this off and thank you for your time.
Thank you for visiting.
Oh.
And for your patience, because these answers could have been shorter.
Well, but the stories wouldn't have been as good.